Boy George now, amongst his other strategies that he has going on in his various wars that have been handed down to him by both Democrats and Republicans. One of Boy George's strategies is to emphasize that the whole problem in this country in the name of a war on terrorism is really the Arabs, Mideast people. People align with them. And the trick will be finding a way to blame them for everything without appearing to do so. In other words, the same strategy that Nixon actually used and Haldeman is quoted as saying can easily be adapted to what Boy George is currently doing in his current war on terrorism. And much of the Gumpified American population is going for it. And since much of the social progressive movement has failed to really address the overall aspect of what these lockdown projects in the inner city mean for the rights of all people, when they lock down certain project housings and you have to have ID to go into them, all under the banner of war on drugs, where certain neighborhoods are cordoned off and you have to show ID to get into these neighborhoods. Well, this is all the same type of apparatus that we've seen currently going on in Fallujah. The same game and the same enemy under the same, well, more or less construct that they developed. And like this war on terrorism, this war on drugs has economic implications for the masses of people in this society. Here's what I mean. Check this out.
We spend on the state, local, and federal levels more on the war on drugs today than we do as a nation on private health insurance. Just the federal drug budget, which is a small portion of this, merely the federal drug budget exceeds the combined budgets of the Commerce, State, and Interior Departments. This is big money. That's why I'm hoping that this is going to become an issue for conservative Americans who profess to be upset about Washington's deficit spending, about entrenched bureaucracies perpetuating government programs that don't work, who profess to be angry about Washington intruding on the lives of individuals, Washington usurping state and local control. This is the daddy of them all in those regards. And it has been immune from criticism because, again, the drug czars were very candid with me about this. Beginning with Jimmy Carter's second drug czar, the drug office has seen itself as not just protecting the public from potentially dangerous substances, but changing the way Americans think and changing the way Americans talk. And there was a deliberate, explicit effort to close the debate on drug abuse and drug policy. And again, this is not me reading into their motives. They explained this to me. They said, we did not want people talking about hard and soft drugs. We didn't want people talking about the difference between drug use and drug abuse. We wanted all contact with all illegal drugs declared equally bad, equally dangerous, equally illegal, and give no quarter at all to any contact with these drugs. Because we can't talk about it. I mean, that's what really frightens me about the drug war. It's forbidden speech.
Forbidden speech. Now, when Boy George and company were first getting ready to charge off into this imperial war under the banner of war on terrorism, it was forbidden speech for many people to even challenge or try to discuss what this war on terrorism means and what are the implications of allowing the state apparatus carte blanche to go haywire on the world population. That was considered treasonous. Professors at universities that sought to discuss this and have, you know, dialogue about this were put on watch lists. People who talked at 24-hour fitnesses found themselves put in a situation, you know, who at 24-hour fitnesses who questioned some of the motivation and prior history of the U.S. Empire involvement in foreign intervention, found themselves visited by FBI agents. The list goes on. Forbidden speech. Well, within the war on drugs, as Baum was pointing out, a whole mindset was developed and orchestrated by the state that for those who wanted to question the legitimacy of the war on drugs, who wanted to seek to find what were some of the motivations behind this, found themselves ostracized, questioned, quote unquote, and on and on. This is how the vehicle of oppression expands itself out. And when you have pivotal issues like these types of wars by the state be able to be orchestrated, you can see how basic rights further erode step by step, period by period, by this whole beast apparatus. No, it hasn't been a situation where people's health care under the current war on terrorism has been taking massive hits. In actuality, as Baum pointed out, when you have more money being spent under this whole war on drugs than on the whole private health insurance apparatus, this has been a long time developing. And where have the Democrats been? Well, under the flag of a war, where wars are made easy. Easy for those who are aligned with the apparatus of the order. Wars made easy, in reality, is a war on us and our basic rights and humanity in this country and throughout the world. Which is why those who are aligned with this beast apparatus, wars are something they so love day by day, year by year, and stripping of rights by rights on Sam's plantation.
That was Tracy James of Slave Revolt Radio. To find his programs and blog, Google Slave Revolt Radio. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, RadioVeronica.us, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. Recently in the news was a UCLA alumni organization which was offering money to students to document which instructors disparaged the Bush regime or were otherwise ideologically unacceptable to the right. One of the primary targets of their attack was Dr. Peter McLaren, a prominent scholar in the philosophy of education who has collaborated with our next guest, Henry Giroux of McMaster's University. We turn now to another of my favorite broadcasters, C.S. Sung of Against the Grain, who takes up the discussion with Giroux of fascism in America.
In recent years, it seems to me there's been increasing discussion about the specter of fascism, and specifically about whether the U.S. is becoming or already is a fascist state. That kind of talk isn't ordinarily accompanied by an in-depth examination into what fascism is and what its key features are, let alone whether those features are in evidence today. Well, that's the kind of discussion we'll have today with someone who's given it a lot of thought. Henry Giroux's most recent book is entitled Against the New Authoritarianism. Henry Giroux is professor of communication studies at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario. He's authored or co-authored over 40 books, including The Mouse That Roared, Disney and the End of Innocence, and The Abandoned Generation, Democracy Beyond the Culture of Fear. The full title of his latest book is Against the New Authoritarianism, Politics After Abu Ghraib, recently out from Arbeiter Ring Publishing. Henry joins us now from his McMaster office. You've been a longtime professor of education, actually. You've written many books about schooling and pedagogy. So what's someone like you doing writing about fascism?
Well, I think one of the things that has always concerned me is the relationship actually between education and democracy itself. And when you find yourself living in a country, as I did in the United States, in which any kind of critical education was increasingly being labeled as a form of either as being un-American or being treasonous, particularly in light of its attempt to criticize certain policies by the Bush administration, foreign and domestic, I became increasingly concerned about how that attack on education sort of manifested itself in a whole series of what you might want to, what I would call educational indicators, you know, ways in which we could register something that was happening to the United States that was really diminishing its claim to being a democratic country.
How would you go about defining fascism and sort of its key indispensable elements?
Well, I think that one of the things that I did in the book, let me begin by saying a couple of things. One is I don't think there's any one static model of fascism. I mean that I think that what Arendt and others, Hannah Arendt and others, were concerned about was the ways in which certain elements often came together to sort of weave themselves in a pattern in a particular historical moment that might close down two things, that might close down the ability of people to either question or dissent in a given society. I mean, she actually said that dissent was actually the central modality of democracy. And secondly, the degree to which people begin to disappear in the political arena. They no longer sort of play a formidable role in shaping the events that in some way address their lives. But what I did was I looked at six or seven elements that I thought were particularly unique to the United States, and that I saw emerging that spoke not very clearly, but spoke in a very threatening way to the way in which the contours of American democracy were changing, at least in terms of both its reality and its promise. And you want to talk about some of those?
Well, sure. And maybe we could start by you simply laying out the elements and then us going into some detail about each one of them.
All right. The first thing that I was very concerned about was what I call the cult of reactionary modernism. I mean, it seems to me that what has happened in the United States is you have a party that's come to power that is not really conservative. It's really revolutionary. And what it attempts to do, what has emerged is this alliance of neoconservatives, extremist evangelicals, Christians, and free market advocates who really sort of see the political order modeled on the presidency of William McKinley and the values of the robber barons. I mean, they want to go back to a time in which the social contract didn't exist, where you really don't have to talk about social provisions, where you don't have to talk about the social state. They want to roll back, in a sense, all of the gains that we have seen from the New Deal to a time in which the market becomes really the only template of how to understand the social order. That was the first issue.
So William McKinley, I just want to let listeners know, was president from 1897 to 1901. And are you saying that historically fascism has always had a certain kind of hostility toward the modern world, toward modernity?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there really is a hostility towards elements of modernity that increasingly speak to the relationship between democracy on one hand and an expansive empowerment of people on the other. It seems to me that where modernity, even as it is in some ways utterly failed, at least spoke to the principles of liberty, equality, justice, and freedom, in this reactionary modernism now espoused by, you know, ultra right wing reactionary mode of the Republican Party, those ideals don't really they get in the way. Democracy becomes an excess, it becomes a burden, and public space, in a sense, in many ways, becomes a kind of pathology.
Okay, so moving on to maybe a second element of fascism.
Well, the second element is the ongoing corporatization of civil society and the diminishing of public space. I mean, it seems to me that increasingly what we see is we see the commanding institutions of society in the hands of very powerful corporate interests, the privileged, and God forbid, I mean, some religious bigots. And increasingly what we see happening is we see politics being rendered corrupt and cynical. I mean, not only because we see the triumph of corporate interest over democratic values, but increasingly what we see is the ongoing elimination of all things public. I mean, the public space is increasingly commercialized, privatized, or militarized. And increasingly what we see is that there are few public spheres available where a language can be developed to actually defend institutions as democratic public spheres. And citizenship increasingly at the same time gets reduced simply to the obligations of consumerism. So we see in this corporatization of civil society, this elimination of civil society, this changing domination of civil society by private, corporate, and religious interest, we see the undermining of those spaces where, in a sense, a public discourse can be, and critical discourse about citizenship and democracy can actually be cultivated.
What Henry, constitutes a public space, a public sphere? A lot of people would think of like a public square, for example, or a town hall meeting. But how would you define?
I think
spaces?
A public sphere is a place that in which people come together. It's a place that is not dominated by commodified values. It's a place that, in a sense, brings people together in order to talk, to debate, to engage in serious kinds of conversations, and to collectively begin to figure out what it means to relate private interests to public concerns, to understand how private problems translate into public concerns. It's a place where voices become public and people can connect in some fundamental way with the larger world in which they find themselves.
And there are two kinds of aspects of public spaces that I want to ask you about. One is political agency and what happens to people's sense of themselves as political agents when public spaces disappear. And secondly, what happens to localized opinion when, again, as you're mentioning, public spaces get closed down?
No, I think this is a fabulous. For me, it's a very important question and one that has really driven my work for a long time. And I think the first thing that happens is that when public spaces get closed down, they're often replaced by utterly privatized or commercialized spaces. And in those spaces, generally, the range of discourses or languages or literacies available for people to really understand themselves as something other than consumers either gets eliminated or is utterly diminished. And so in a sense, when you close down these public spheres or these public spaces, you don't have values or discourses or languages or social relations emerging that can make people attentive to what it means to live in a democracy, to fight for it, and to struggle over it. It's very dangerous when, in fact, we find ourselves endlessly moving through a variety of spheres in which you never hear the word democracy. You never hear the word justice. You never, in a sense, allow modes of disagreement to take place, where dialogue and exchange takes place, or people become attentive to how their lives articulate and are related to larger public forms. So in a sense, their identities as political agents gets utterly stunted in many ways and reduced to the most, in my estimation, I mean, the most debilitating forms of identity, often about being a consumer or being a shopper. You know, as Bush said after 9/11, we can really make the country work. You know, please go shopping. I mean, there it is, right? I mean, don't be critically engaged. I mean, make sure you can simply find your way to Neiman Marcus.
And local opinion, what happens to that? Or
I think that what often happens, CS, to local opinion is that it gets eliminated. I mean, and I'll give you an example of this. I mean, we all know that when you have these major corporations taking over, for instance, the media, and they become utterly centralized and in many ways utterly indifferent to the specificity of history, to the specificity of local events, the discourse, in a sense, becomes so generalized, so commercialized, so utterly privatized that it becomes difficult for people to, in a sense, not only find out what often is going on in the neighborhoods in which they live, but how that connects them to broader kinds of considerations and broader kinds of issues. Couple this sort of rampant commercialization and privatization and this indifference to local events, couple that with often an ideological agenda that actually shuts down dissent and shuts down engaged kinds of conversation by somehow suggesting in a fox-like way that these are all treasonous, and something begins to emerge. I mean, a particular kind of understanding of what the culture in the country is about and what agency is about that emerges that, in my estimation, becomes very dangerous. But I think the classic story is there was a train wreck somewhere in the U.S., you know, and they're trying to alert, they wanted to call the local radio station to alert them that, you know, they could to make the kinds of announcements that have people leave their houses within the vicinity, and there was no one there. I mean, there was no phone. I mean, they had to call Seattle because these kind of local spaces are being eliminated and sort of endlessly commercialized and eaten up by corporations, which actually make those spaces dysfunctional.
Some listeners, Henry, might think, well, you know, I could go down to my local cafe, and sure, maybe it's owned by a business, but it's a small business. There are ways, in other words, for me to go out and interact with fellow citizens, fellow residents. So what would you say to them, people who might think there are public spaces out there still?
Well, I mean, I'm not suggesting that all public spaces have been eliminated. I think that's silly. And I'm not suggesting that there aren't spaces that are commercially owned that can't be hybridized, that in some way are both commercial and public. I think we see that. But I also think that we also see the elimination of those spaces not endlessly not driven by profit, that basically exclude people in ways that would have really produced, conditioned, and allowed a much greater form of interaction to take place. I'll give you the classic example. You know, I mean, when I was a kid, there were boys' clubs. I mean, there were all kinds of social spaces that young people could get together in and, in a sense, sort of talk about things outside of what it meant to buy T-shirts, you know, or buy goods. I mean, increasingly, you don't find that at all. You have to pay just to get on the basketball court. The only place kids can hang out are basically the mall. I mean, you walk onto a college campus today, and everything is owned by a giant corporation, and the central message that they're producing is that you have to be a consumer, not a learner. So I think that while there are, of course, exceptions, and, of course, people sometimes use these places in ways that they're not designed to be used, I think increasingly as those social spaces disappear or as they become pathologized, it becomes difficult to even imagine a mode of behavior taking place in those places outside of what commercial interests often dictate to be the appropriate conversation, the appropriate behavior, or the appropriate exchange.
Henry Giroux joins us by phone from his office in Hamilton, Ontario. He's a professor of communication studies at McMaster University there. He's the author or co-author of dozens of books, including Schooling and the Struggle for Public Life. So we've talked about sort of a hostility to modernism. We've talked about the shutting down of public space. What other elements, give us another element of fascism that you think exists today?
Well, certainly one of the most important that I focus on in the book is what I call the militarization of public life. And what I mean by that is this ongoing intensification of labor and resources, basically allocated to military concerns, military purposes, including not only the shaping of institutions, but the shaping of language, the shaping of fashion, the shaping of space, I mean, the shaping of particular forms of agency. You know, we live in a country, as you know, at least living in the United States, that has more police, more prisons, more spies, more weapons, more soldiers than at any other time in its history. I mean, it has 725 bases that circle the globe. It has, we're now watching, seeing the emergence of privatized armies, kind of rental Rambos, many of whom are involved in torture and abuse in the United States. We not only see a militarism that promotes an aggressive foreign policy, but in many ways affects domestic policy by expanding police power, augmenting the military-industrial complex, legitimating unchecked male power. And I'll give you like two really kind of obvious examples of this. I mean, for anybody, for instance, who's concerned about education, I mean, one of the things that we see both at the levels of public and higher education, at public education, schools are increasingly being modeled after prisons. I mean, you have zero tolerance policies in which police play an enormously central role in how schools are run and how they, and certainly in disciplining behavior. I mean, what years ago was an infraction in which a kid would simply go to a guidance counselor is now seen as a criminal offense. Some kids have violated dress codes. Police come in, they handcuff them, and they take them away in police cruises. You have massive forms of surveillance in the schools. I mean, you have rules that, in a sense, suggest that kids in some way have to, that it's more important to punish them than, in fact, to teach them something critical. Secondly, I mean, the thing that I find amazing is you now have tourists posing in U.S. cities with soldiers for photo ops so that militarization has become, the militarization of the culture has become so commonplace that it becomes like a celebrity moment in the culture. You have Ford producing something called the Ford Sinus, which is described, are you ready for this, as a rolling urban command center. I mean, you know, in which you can lock the whole thing, and you have bulletproof windows on it. You have a screen in the back for surveillance if you want to see who's outside of your vehicle. I mean, this a particular kind of agency is being put into place here that not only suggests that armed power is now the greatest measure of national greatness, but that war and warriors have become the most enduring symbols of the American way of life. That, to me, is a central element of fascism.
What values does militarization at home instill in people, promote among people?
I think it promotes a sense of competition. I think excessive competition promotes a sense of rabid masculinity. I think that in many ways it seems to suggest that it's more important for people to be engaged around a shared sense, around the rituals of violence and the rituals of shared responsibilities. I think it tends to view all social problems as inherently criminal problems. I think it often operates off a divide between us and them that leaves very little room for debate and dialogue. I think it often promotes hierarchies of the worst order in which authority essentially doesn't have to be explained and appears beyond logic appears to be unaccountable. I think it's very dangerous.
And what happens to values like dialogue, for example, negotiation, compassion, when militarization hits hard at home?
When it hits hard at home, they become basically excess values. If they don't become pathologized by being viewed as girly values, as you know, Governor Schwarzenegger would argue, they appear to be, in a sense, almost unpatriotic. They appear to they're weak. They give in to the enemy. You know, they don't make us, as Adorno said in talking about, you know, how you would imagine education after Auschwitz. He said, "This they promote the ideology of hardness and reification. You know, human beings become the other. They become things. They, in a sense, celebrate a notion of power that in many ways is really at odds with all of the values you just mentioned. Compassion, justice, a sense of the other, you know, some sort of sense of what it means to take social needs and social justice seriously."
And you remind us in your book, Against the New Authoritarianism, that Time magazine's Person of the Year in 2003 was the American soldier. Then, Henry, there's the rise of militarized video games. Is this actually about, as you write, quote, preparing young Americans for armed conflict?
Yeah, well, if you look at these games, I mean, what I find so interesting is the military is now in the entertainment business around video games, and video games have actually become one of the main recruiting tools that they use to not only recruit high school students. I mean, it's really a very powerful tool. But the representations in these video games are basically about people being killed. I mean, it's the celebrations of violence. I mean, how do you use a gun? You know, how do you trade? And there's one game, and I can't remember the name of it now. I mentioned it in the book, the most recent game where you can actually go online and play the game in, I don't want to say real time, but in a time that sort of imitates recent events. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden the game, for instance, might be modeled after killing the killing of Saddam Hussein's sons in Iraq. You know, how they found the place, what they did, they went in, moving with the troops. I mean, you know, there are people who say that these games are relatively innocent, and I'm not in any way ever suggesting by a long shot that there's a correlation between watching the game and becoming violent. I think that's silly. But I do think that they legitimate certain values. And I do think they give a higher priority to some forms of identity over others. And I do think they raise fundamental questions about what it means to live in a culture in which violence becomes the most important and enduring symbol around around which people come together. And what the implications of that might mean in terms of how it legitimates other issues related to that violence.
If we can get back
to state violence.
Yeah. If we can get back to this idea of the ideology of hardness, and this was brought up by, as you write in your book, the German thinker Theodor Adorno. In 1967, he published an essay entitled Education After Auschwitz. And there are a couple of things you refer to in this section of your book. One is reality TV shows, and the other is the degree to which the Nazis were actually ashamed, in some sense, of what was happening in places like Auschwitz. Talk about that.
Oh, it's very interesting. When I wrote the book, you know, I sent it to Zygmunt Bauman, who was a friend of mine, very important, one of the top flight sociologists in the world, in his 80s, and his wife Jenna had been in one of the concentration camps, and he said, Henry, the one thing you left out, he said, the one thing that was very interesting for him was that the Nazis tried to hide it. They didn't take photos and send them all around the place, you know. I mean, it was like people were ashamed. I mean, there was a sense of shame around what was going on. It was kept in incredible secrecy, shrouded in secrecy. Whereas it seems to me that one of the things that we see here, and it here being Abu Ghraib, and of course, and who knows, any of the other prisons that we're now discovering exist, CIA produced, is that. And of course, the multiple videos and images that are now coming out, and now the courts have refused to release. I mean, this celebration, this kind of frat boy sort of celebration of violence, this kind of these images that so reify the other that in the face of the most inhumane, disgusting, and humiliating and punishing kinds of rituals, people cannot simply find joy but glee and use that as a way to sort of, in a sense, entrust and entail communication with others. I mean, that says something about the culture that we need to ask ourselves about. I mean, how do you get educated for this? I mean, what is it that goes on in the culture that condenses pain, humiliation, and abuse into digestible spectacles of violence while legitimating them in retrograde philosophies like militarism? I mean, you know, what happens in the rest of the society that allows this sort of thing to take place? What pedagogical functions are going on in the culture that, in a sense, harden people or hardwire them into these kinds of values and social relations? This is not merely a military question.
My name is C.S. Song, and joining us today is Henry Giroux. He is a professor of communication studies at McMaster University in Ontario, and he's author most recently of Against the New Authoritarianism, Politics After Abu Ghraib, recently out from the Arbiter Ring Publishing Group in Ontario, I believe. And I want to ask you, Henry, about a guy named Bertram Gross. He wrote a book in the early 1980s entitled Friendly Fascism. What did he have to say about fascism and its possible emergence in this country?
Well, I mean, he said if fascism came to the United States, to put it very succinctly, he said it would come with a smiling face. You know, it wouldn't come in the form of brown shirts, goose-stepping in the streets. And I mean, actually, he's been echoed by a number of people, including Umberto Eco and others who claim that, and Chris Hedges actually recently in Hoppers, who said that if fascism comes to the United States, it's going to come with people reading Bibles who are wrapping themselves in the flag and singing the Star Spangled Banner. And I guess the point was that to simply talk about fascism emerging in the United States does not mean that we would see it in its most excessive forms, in its most extreme forms, particularly those that took place in Italy, fascist Italy and Nazi Germany.
Now, to the degree that fascism is a mass movement, what role does individualism play? Because unbridled individualism is part of your and many people on the left's understanding of what's happening today. The political and economic system promotes a very serious, you know, what can I get for myself? I don't need anybody else, or you shouldn't need, for example, government support. If unbridled individualism is a key feature of what's happening today, how does that fit in with this idea of a mass movement under fascism?
I mean, I think there are three ways to talk about this. I mean, I think that at one level, this kind of individualism has no language for being able to recognize anti-democratic tendencies because it often collapses public issues into private considerations. Hence, people become increasingly depoliticized by virtue of this individualized language and susceptible to really very simplistic, often, understandings of how the world and the country works and who the enemy is and who it isn't. Secondly, it seems to me that what this kind of individualism does besides utterly depoliticizing people is it tends to place them in a position of believing that the only way in which one can really understand and both operate in the world is to engage in the most extreme and rabid forms of competition. I mean, it has no way of sort of celebrating those kinds of democratic values in which social needs and compassion become crucial to a democracy itself. So it essentially undercuts the kinds of values that I think that really make a democracy vibrant and make it work. Thirdly, it often functions in a way to not simply not have a language for defending vital public institutions, but it has no way of defending itself against those rituals of symbolic violence that attack public institutions at every level. In other words, the attack on the welfare state, the attack on the schools, you know, the attack on potentially socialized medicine, the attack on Medicaid and Medicare, the attack on unions. I mean, these are all social organizations that escape the logic of individualism. I mean, they just don't fit into that logic. And hence, it seems to me that without a broader sort of understanding of one's role, not simply as an individual, but a social agent, and lacking a broader understanding of the meaning and the value of democracy itself, and thirdly, having no language to justify institutions that strengthen it, there is a tendency for people to move away, to move within that limited discourse into the most extremist kinds of discourses.
As a longtime educator, I know for a long time you've been fascinated with language, with how people express themselves, with how people write and talk. What happens to language under fascism?
Oh, it becomes a version of Orwellian newspeak. I mean, I don't think we've ever seen a greater example of that than we see in the United States today. I mean, it's just absolutely insane. You know, I mean, we imagine, CS, this is a country that abducts people off the street, sends them to fascist countries to be tortured, and we call that extraordinary rendition. I mean, this is a language that destroys environmental laws. And in one instance, one particular law that was terribly weakened to allow mercury emissions to be much greater than what they should be, we call that the Clean Air Act. This is a country that turns lies into mythologies. I mean, I really believe that the Vice President of the United States in some way has convinced himself that if he says the same lie over and over again, it'll just appear eventually to be the truth. I mean, it's something like we've never seen before. I mean, but it's even more than simply misrepresentation, and it's more than simply misdirection. I mean, they create lies, I mean, and then pass them off as news. I mean, you know, we know all this stuff. The recent revelations about fake news reporters, you know, people being planted, editors being bought off in the Middle East, in Iraq, people being paid to Armstrong Williams. I mean, it must be humiliating, you know, to be paid to support, you know, the Every Child Left Behind bill. I'm kidding, of course, right? Which is what it should be named. You know, it goes on and on. I mean, we find ourselves in a country that actually a government that takes something very seriously. They take seriously the notion that culture is the most powerful form of education today, and they want to do everything they can to, in a sense, shape that culture according to their own interest. And they do it through the media, which is another, of course, element of fascism. They control the media, or they pay people off, or in fact they limit access to the news, or they shroud the government in a veil of secrecy unlike anything we have ever seen before. they break the law, and then they claim they're not breaking the law. I mean, this new, you know, this unwarrant, the use of the refusal to use warrants to spy on Americans, and then the claim that yes, it's really justified, it's really part of the Constitution. I mean, it's endless, and I think it's very dangerous. And it actually says something very, very important about the necessity to educate people to be able to not only read text critically, but also to recognize that they're not just being educated in schools, they're being educated through a whole range of sites and institutions and processes that actually have become far more powerful than traditional forms of education in shaping their political views.
And you just referred, of course, to the Bush administration compensating conservative pundits like Armstrong Williams to push the Bush line on a number of things. And Bush's comment in support, in defense of this hitherto secret domestic spying program, which was outed last month. He said, quote, "The American people expect me to do everything in my power under our laws to protect them and our civil liberties, and that is exactly what I will continue to do." That's an example, I take it.
That's more than an example. That's almost a caricature. I mean, it borders on being a caricature. To sort of spy on Americans and to do it unlawfully, and then to claim that that operates in the name of civil liberties, is to just bang your head against the wall and ask yourself if you're in a Marx Brothers cartoon. I think that what you have here is you have an arrogance of power so manifestly displayed that it really believes two things. It believes, A, that the power that it does have does not come from the Constitution. It comes from, I'm assuming, some divine being, if we're to believe Bush, Ashcroft, and the others who engage in these prayer meetings every day. And secondly, that to hold power accountable is somehow un-American. That's not part of the logic of democracy. This is what's so frightening. I mean, when you have a language operating in the interest of saying, don't hold us accountable because, A, it doesn't matter, we have power, and this is the arrogance of power, B, most of the media are sort of lapdogs, so, you know, we don't worry about them, and C, we don't see mass movements contesting what we do anyways. That becomes a little scary when those elements start to come into play to that degree.
Well, a lot of people might think that George W. Bush speaks so simply because he, you know, he's not very intelligent. He doesn't know a lot of polysyllabic words. What's your sense of?
I think that's utterly naive. I think that George Bush is not simply a personality. He's the president of the United States. He's the head of a political party. He's the head of a rabid right-wing political movement. He's surrounded by advisors who constantly either engage in dialogue or tell him what to do. I mean, he's simply the tip of something that, in a sense, has been going on for a long time. It began in the night. It began with Goldberg, which is Barry
Goldwater.
Barry Goldwater, and it all of a sudden found its greatest expression in the Project for the New American Century, ultimately with all the neoconservatives that we all know. So to simply privatize this is really to fall into one of the great traps of modern neoliberalism, and that is not to sort of understand private considerations and to translate them into public concerns, into social issues. This is a social issue. It's a much larger political issue. It's not about his speech impediment.
And you also write that his very simple talk trivializes complexity. It limits the instruments for complex and critical reasoning. It's a way, in a sense, of modeling the way people might think and talk, or the way that he wants people to think and talk, which is very simplistic, not a lot of reasons given for what he's doing, simple ways of speaking.
No, I think that's absolutely right. I think that he models a certain kind of political illiteracy. And I think that illiteracy, in a sense, becomes very important for this administration because they thrive on it. I mean, they either want to believe that most people are entirely stupid and that they can do almost anything they want and get away with it, or they want, in a sense, to make sure that there are no public spaces and spheres around that would provide people with the skills, the knowledge, the values, the critical literacy that might challenge that.
What happens, and you've already begun to refer to this, Henry, to the church-state divide under fascism?
Well, I think that what we see under this particular form of authoritarianism emerging in the United States is that the church-state divide increasingly collapses. We have never, ever seen so many ultra-right-wing Christians all of a sudden having access to the highest reaches of power in the way that we see today. I mean, we have a president who really believes that he engages in a dialogue with God, who really believes, I mean, in various books and conversations, has suggested that he was appointed, that he heard a voice. We have him absolutely legitimating and catering in many ways to the religious right from on almost all the major policy issues that they're concerned about, from homophobia to questions of women's reproductive rights to questions of sex education. But the sad and unfortunate thing is these are not just simply quirky people who have quirky views who get airtime. What's so dangerous here is that they're shaping policy, and they're shaping policy in a way that's going to have a long-term effect on the democratic vibrancy and health of the United States. Already we see it with two Supreme Court appointments that could have far-reaching effects, particularly Alito if he's appointed for women's reproductive rights. We see it in the attempt in many ways to censor the larger culture. I mean, I don't know if you know this, but you know when the new Secretary of Education was appointed a couple of years ago, or a year ago, whatever it was, the first thing she did was issue a statement criticizing PBS for a program called Postcards, a cartoon program called Postcards from Buster. Do you know about this program?
No.
It was a program in which Buster the Rabbit, I believe, went around and interviewed different families. Well, poor Buster. He made a terrible mistake of interviewing a lesbian family. A family with two lesbian women, and they went berserk. And, you know, you think to yourself, my God, you know, where does it end? Because it seems to me that this kind of imminent theocracy, as Frank Richwood, the New York Times columnist, recently suggested, not only censors, but it lives in a world in which there's either evil or good. I mean, it demonizes those who are not on the side of the angels, and it absolutely enshrouds in a veil of utter self-righteousness and moral complacency those who, of course, are on the other side. And in the end, it eliminates debate. It's a discourse that prevents people from becoming critical agents, and it tends to support a kind of foolish ignorance over questions of critical reason. I mean, reason now becomes a liability. You know, so we teach creationism and call it science. Or we say that we appoint David Haggard, you know, to a high government post in which he issues statements saying that if women really want have PMS, they should read the Bible to get rid of it. Or we support pharmacists who don't want to hand out birth control pills to women on the basis of the pharmacist's religious beliefs. I mean, it's endless. But maybe in the last instance, the thing that is the most scary for me is, you know, all this talk about, you know, Christians being, you know, white Christians being the saved race has a very interesting kind of similarity to another kind of racial purity that we heard in the 1930s and 40s. You know, when a guy like David Haggard appears in an interview with Barbara Walters and she says, well, can non-Christians go to heaven? And he says, no, I'm afraid not. What are the implications of that for Muslims, for Arabs? What are the implications for that for Jews? What are the implications for all those others who don't bear the stamp of that kind of religious purity? The implication is that they're evil. And when people sort of fall on the side of evilness, they become and become demonized. It's a very small step from so reifying them that they're no longer human.
And who is David Haggard?
David Haggard is he was appointed to a high post by the Bush administration in the
Food and Drug Administration. Yes. That
guy. He played a very influential role in preventing the morning after pill from actually getting passed.
You write that the faith-based initiatives funded by the Bush administration often give priority to religious conversion among people they serve. Why bring this up, Henry?
Well, because I think it operates out of a certain kind of hypocrisy. I mean, Bush tries to legitimate the allocating money to these faith-based institutions on the grounds that they really do good work, right? And there are two things to say about that. One is you have to understand, the more you take and you give money to charities, religious-based or otherwise, the less you have to depend on government services, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a not-so-hidden agenda there. But secondly, I mean, you know, it violates the Constitution. I mean, if these people basically are getting federal money to promote religious views, then they don't deserve that money. It's actually illegal. And in many cases, Bush says they don't do that. They provide services that are very necessary, child care, daycare. But it's very interesting because in many, you know, the research is all out there. Even those organizations that he often mentions in his inaugural addresses to endlessly push this line, it ends up they're all conversion organizations. They're all about, you know, converting people to Christianity. They're all about, you know, using the notion of social services as a pretext to sort of get you in the church so they can then work on you. And I think we have to recognize this, and we have to recognize how dangerous it basically is. I mean, social services should not be in the business of religious conversion, and they certainly should not be in the business of religious conversion when they're funded by you know, my tax money and yours.
And I want to ask you about, and it keeps coming up in the context of your comments, but neoliberalism and what it means for fascist tendencies, whether it facilitates them, whether it encourages them, whether it necessarily ought to accompany an emerging fascism. What is your sense?
No, I think that what neoliberalism does is because of its whole range of reasons. I mean, I think it tends to facilitate those kinds of forms of agency, those kinds of spaces, those kinds of social relationships that really are, in many ways, very insensitive to democratic tendencies, values, identities, and practices. I think that when you talk about neoliberalism, for me, what that means is that the market becomes the only template for social relations, that profit-making becomes the essence of democracy, that consumerism becomes the epitome of what it means to engage in citizenship activities, that privatization becomes far more important than, for instance, talking about public space or public goods or public life, that public issues get collapsed into private issues. And I think that, you know, and of course, accompanied by generally the elimination of government regulations for big business, the celebration of a kind of ruthless individualism, the commercialization of public spheres, all of these things in their extreme, all of these things, it seems to me, erode the most fundamental institutional, ideological, social sort of dimensions of a vibrant democracy. Democracy in that logic is basically an excess. Democracy gets in the way because democracy is really less about commercial needs than it is about social needs, really less about commercial spheres and commodified values than it is about justice, equality, and freedom, less about the isolated rabid individual than it is about communities of learners and communities, spiritual communities, and people who can get together and take seriously social justice, less concerned about individuals as shoppers than it is about individuals as engaged citizens.
A different kind of individual autonomy was advocated by this German thinker, Theodor Adorno, the force of self-reflection and self-determination, the will, he wrote, to refuse participation in what was going on around them. How is that individual autonomy, both, and you mentioned the distinction earlier on between critical thinking on the one hand, very, very important, and in a sense, the power to imagine a better future and the power to plan for it and devise strategies and projects around a better world. How, given the militarization of culture, given what's happening to education and the media and reality TV and the religious rhetoric, how in the world does such individual autonomy get fostered?
Well, I mean, for me, as you well know, because you've looked at this book, I mean, first and foremost, the question of religious, the question of individual autonomy, individual self-determination, as opposed to simply individual development, it emerges out of an educational process that takes place in many places, that in some way takes seriously what it means to link learning to democratic social change. I mean, what it means to link learning to critical reflection, what it means to link learning to democratic values, what it means to link learning to a culture of questioning, what it means to suggest that you can't learn without assuming some sort of sense of social responsibility. In other words, what we learn gets connected to public life vis-a-vis a concern for deepening and expanding democratic practices, virtues and ideas and identities rather than shutting them down. So the question that then has to be raised is, what kind of education and in what sites do we have to fight for nurturing sets of capacities and critical skills and modes of ethics that, in a sense, would reinforce and reproduce and sustain and extend those modes of agency and individual autonomy that can only define themselves through a democratic society rather than simply against it?
And where might those sites exist?
Well, I think those sites have to, clearly they have to exist in public schools. Clearly they have to exist in higher education. Clearly the media plays an absolutely central role in reproducing, perpetuating, circulating these kinds of ideas. They have to exist in religious institutions that link themselves to democracy and not to sort of, you know, this Manichaean sense of dividing the world into good and bad. I think there are all kinds of spaces, social spaces, that they have to exist in. But I think that what has to take place for education to be understood as fundamental to democracy itself is that we have to take seriously those institutions that make it possible. And I think we've put ourselves at a time when public institutions such as education, such as higher education, are under such assault that if pedagogy and itself, education itself, does not become central to any kind of democratic political movement, trust me, it's going to fail.
And the right has accused university curricula and faculty as being too liberal.
This is another part of the big lie. You know, I don't know about you, but I travel all over the United States, and I give talks in many, many universities. And I must tell you, if I can find more than five leftists on a campus, you know, it's like a party. Go to the business school. Go to engineering. Go to the medical schools. Go to the agricultural schools. In the liberal arts, if the liberal arts are now, if they've been taken over by the left, why is it you find that the vast majority of students are so conservative? And what's this stuff that the right suggests? It says that if they can somehow determine your political affiliation by looking at voter registration rolls, they can automatically assume how you teach in a classroom? That's quite a leap. Even the statistics that they use to somehow put forth this ludicrous idea. But again, remember, this has become obvious. People like David Horowitz, you know, who in the name of, are you ready, academic freedom and academic balancing, want to provide some kind of political litmus test in terms of how we discuss what faculties do. I mean, that's fascism. I mean, when all of a sudden one's politics becomes the ultimate marker rather than one's scholarship for what one does, you're treading in a very dangerous place. That's as bad as people disappearing. Because one of the first things the Nazis did, and we all know this, is they completely purged the universities. They knew what it meant to turn the universities into simply, how do you say, factories for the reproduction of fascist ideology. And I think that for many conservatives, that's exactly what they want. And what they want is they want to do it by claiming that somehow they're an oppressed minority within the university. It's silly.
We have to leave it right there. Henry Giroux, you can find out more about his recent book, Against the New Authoritarianism, Politics After Abu Ghraib, as well as all the other books and interests he has on our website, againstthegrain.org.
And that was C.S. Sung at againstthegrain.org. A reminder for Ithaca listeners, tomorrow, Monday, January 30th, a public hearing on the proposed renaming of State Street after Martin Luther King Jr. That will be from 7 to 8:30 p.m. in the Beverly Livesay Room of the DSS building at 320 West State Street in downtown Ithaca. 1,300 citizens and 50 State Street businesses have already signed on in support. Our website is unwelcomeguests.org, and our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for hearing. By unwelcome travelers.